Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Lisa Burke Show. As always, I am so delighted that you've got a little bit of time to join us wherever you are in the world. And as always, thank you so much for writing in and sending in some feedback about other shows that you've picked up on during the course of a few years now that I've been doing shows. So I really do like it when you send a note or a thought, and I will read them out if I think they're good for the rest of the audience. Now, today, I am hoping this will be of benefit to everybody, of course. We're going to talk about brain health matters, risk reduction and dementia prevention. Many of us here in Europe and around the world, we're lucky if we can grow older, and there is an aging demographic. With this come various diseases, such as dementia. And for a long time, people thought this was an inevitable part of aging. But we're going to learn today that, as with so many diseases, lifestyle changes from a young age can counteract this. So in the studio with me, I have two guests, and we have brought a bit of springtime colour because we're recording this on a day when there is glorious sunshine outside here in Luxembourg. I have Dr. Ange Bradshaw. She's the Director for Research at Alzheimer's Europe, which is a Luxembourg-based NGO and an umbrella organisation that's working to improve the lives of people affected by dementia across Europe. And I also have Dr. Joël Fritz, who is a research and strategy specialist at the Luxembourg Institute of Health, where she aims to bridge research and clinical care. And joining us online from Sweden, I have Dr. Francesca Mangialasse. I know, I've got that entirely wrong. Mangialasse. Anyway, Francesca, lovely to have you with us. You're a geriatrician. You are at the Division of Clinical Geriatrics, Alzheimer's Research Center, Department of Neurobiology, Care Sciences and Society at the very wonderful Karolinska Institute in Sweden. You are also the executive director of the Worldwide Fingers Global Scientific Coordinating Center at the Fingers Brain Health Institute. And joining from Switzerland, I have Hassan Fadli, who is the founder of the Five Ironmans Beat Alzheimer's Association. So welcome, firstly, to all of my guests, and thank you for giving us your time today. I'm going to start with a Luxembourg-based lady, and you actually grew up here as well, and you have a wonderful biological background. But I have just one question to start. What is the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia?
Thanks, Lisa. And that's a really great question to start the show with. And I'm delighted to be here back in my home country of Luxembourg. So Alzheimer's disease is a form of dementia. So when we speak to people on the street, a lot of the time they'll say, oh, you know, my parent has Alzheimer's disease. And actually, a lot of the time they'll be thinking about dementia, the symptoms of dementia. So things like memory loss, maybe some confusion, some challenges in navigating and finding your way around. But actually, Alzheimer's disease is only one of actually hundreds of different underlying disease processes that cause the symptoms of dementia. Alzheimer's disease is linked to the presence of these protein bundles that build up in your brain. And what those protein bundles do is they damage the structure of your brain. And that causes the symptoms like the memory loss and the symptoms of dementia. But it's a really broad term. Dementia is a very broad term. And actually, it covers things that can happen in Parkinson's disease or things that are associated with other neurodegenerative disorders that people might have heard of, like ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. So simple question, but actually a complicated answer.
Yeah, and the research is, it's getting going. And of course, in Luxembourg here, we have a focus on research for neurodegenerative diseases. But bringing it to the personal caregiver's life, Hassan, you are, from memory, an engineer by training. We met at a brain event actually in Brussels a couple of years ago. And your story really sat with me because it is one of a personal journey. And it was, firstly, you were a caregiver to your father in a village in Normandy when you grew up there, and his story. So talk us through why you have changed your entire life to fight for this.
Yeah, that's a question I asked. My dad asked me a day in a garden in Normandy. He told me, how about you do something for the community? How about you do something for us about, he got in mind the stigma and the trauma we were facing in this small village, even though everybody knew that he was suffering with this disease. But the society has a lack of information, lack of information about the disease and the disease progression. So that day he asked me to do something, and the very next day I went for a run, because running for me is good to get inspired and to brainstorm some ideas. And I came back from this session with a mission, not only to call for action, but to try to drive a change, racing for memory, racing to beat Alzheimer's, racing 5 Ironmans in 1 year. This is to break the stigma and to break the taboo about Alzheimer's, and to open up the door, to share knowledge, to share information, to connect the people, to engage the people, to promote also some good practices that we have learned along the way. So the first mission is to race for memory and to engage the community. And a week later, I met with my brother-in-law, who is a filmmaker, and he told me, how about beyond breaking the stigma, we raise also awareness with a documentary movie, a comprehensive documentary movie film along the way, along the 5 races in 5 countries in Europe, in South Europe, in Central Europe, in North Europe, with the aim to better understand good practices, solutions, what South Europe is doing about managing family members and persons with dementia, and same in Central Europe and North Europe. And today, to date, we have achieved to raise 5 Ironmans. So it's quite a lot. It was a 30,000 kilometer training and 2,000 kilometer racing, but racing for this brilliant cause, which is Alzheimer's. I could raise maybe much more than 5. And I can tell you, 5 Ironmans is nothing to compare with the struggle every day when you take care of your lovely dad and your lovely mom, who is suffering from being a caregiver. And today we have also filmed 50 days. We've been filming with doctors, with scientists, policymakers. We've been filming with nursing homes. We've been filming with all the actors supporting basically the research and also diagnostic and also post-diagnostic and treatment. And we are going to deliver this comprehensive documentary by end of 2025.
Thank you, Hassan. I mean, there's so much to dig into here, but I want to bring it right back to that first experience, and we'll get onto the sport part. And congratulations, by the way. I mean, we're just all kind of in awe of somebody who can run 1 Ironman, or run at all, actually. But the stigma, this is something that perhaps we know about if we have witnessed somebody with dementia or Alzheimer's in our community. But what did you experience as a family? When you say stigma, what does that mean?
I mean, attitude and behavior from society. You go to the market, you go to the train station, you go to just for a walk, and you meet with some people, and some people, they have weird reaction. And because they have a lack of information, they have lack of knowledge, and they have misconduct, basically, because of the stigma about the symptoms. And some attitude my dad was suffering due to the disease was basically, we were getting some sad behavior from the people that we knew since 50 years.
So, and it was, so part of your work is to raise awareness, and you're bringing it right down grassroots. I know that you're going into schools with your work, and you're also meeting people like the Queen of Sweden. So this the whole range there. Turning to Sweden, Francesca, obviously with your name, which I can't pronounce, you have a fabulous Italian heritage, but you are at the Karolinska Institute. And you've worked on this for so long. My first question to you really is dementia inevitable?
No, I would say we should always keep in mind that it's not a normal part of aging, neither Alzheimer's disease, neither dementia. So it is something that we can avoid. It is avoidable. We don't know what is the individual destiny of a single individual, but we know that there are many things that we can do to reduce the risk. Same way we try, for instance, to avoid smoking, to avoid lung cancer, and we can do many things to avoid or delay as much as possible cognitive problems. And delaying cognitive problems might really make a difference for some old people in living a life free of cognitive problems.
So one thing is delaying. Is there any way in which it could be reversible?
I would say at the moment it is maybe not yet fully achieved, because when it comes to pharmacological intervention, we have now new medication that have been recently approved that can help slow down the accumulation of the brain damage of Alzheimer type, the protein that Angie mentioned earlier. And in the same, when somebody has a vascular brain damage, and we have a lot of medication that can help stabilize and avoid the occurrence of new damage. Completely reverse, it's something that I'm not sure is still possible. But one thing I also know it's possible is to increase the resilience of the brain to the damage. So each of us has a brain that is a wonder machine. It has a lot of resilience and capacity to compensate. That's why, for instance, when people have stroke, they might not be able to move a limb for a while, but then they rehabilitate and recover. In a similar way, we have to think of the brain as a muscle. We can train it so it becomes stronger and more resilient to tolerate more damage before we hit that threshold that we cannot compensate anymore. And we start to have problems in being independent in our daily life, because that's what it matters as we want. We grow old. We want to have the freedom to decide and the ability to carry on independently many activities.
I was looking at some of the information, and of course, anybody who has witnessed in their family, like Hassan, somebody suffering with dementia will think, oh my goodness, that will be my old age. This might happen to me. So they're very cognizant of that potential future. How common, what is the percentage of people who genetically are predisposed to dementia of one form or another?
I think we have to make one important distinction. There are some genetic conditions that really cause Alzheimer's disease. And those conditions, the people that have this mutation, it's almost unavoidable to develop Alzheimer's disease that causes dementia. But thankfully, these represent only 1 or 2% of all dementia cases. These are a very small minority. And for this type of population, there is a strong genetic drive that we are studying and trying to counteract with mainly medication. But then there are what we call genetic risk factors. When we speak of a risk factor, we speak of something that is not necessary, neither sufficient to cause a disease. The most well-known in our field, in the field of Alzheimer's disease and dementia, is the APOE gene that is very important for our metabolism. And we have three different types of the gene. It could be epsilon 3, epsilon 2, and epsilon 4. The carriers of the epsilon 4 can have an increased risk. But we really need to understand that being carrier of one or two genetic copies of the epsilon 4 might not be sufficient to have dementia. There will be many people that develop dementia even if they don't have it. And there are people that have it and will never develop dementia. One important aspect also to keep in mind is that research is telling us that the people that are carrier of this genetic factor seems to be more vulnerable to the detrimental effect of an healthy lifestyle. For instance, an healthy diet, physical inactivity, or even smoking. So if people that are carriers of this genetic risk embrace a healthier lifestyle, they can quite downplay the effect of this genetic factor. And I think it's important to know, because these genetic tests are now available for purchase online, and it's important that when someone decides to take that assessment, it's also ready to deal with the results and take the necessary step.
Yeah, which is the case for so many genetic tests, and I'm sure they wouldn't undertake that lightly. Something else that I read in the literature is that dementia prevalence, it's higher in women than in men, and obviously it increases with age. So some of the facts I have here, it's doubling about every 5 years until 85. So in 2019 and in 2050, I was looking at these figures. So 2050, the prevalence of dementia in men
is going to be around about 0.1% among 40 to 69. Then it goes up to about 6.5%, 70 to 84. And then it goes up again beyond 85. But these figures are higher for women. And then in the latter age category, it's about 30% for women over 85. Why is it more prevalent in women?
The first thing that we have to keep in mind is that on average, women live longer. And in the Western society, the life expectancy of a female, it's about 7 years longer than men.
But that doesn't explain the difference. There is even a difference when the men are still alive.
Yes, that is true. That is true. So there are some hypotheses that are in particular related, for instance, to the biological hormones that are different between male and female that kind of explain. So up until, for instance, the menopause, we are protected for cardiovascular disease. So heart attack and stroke, we are less at risk. After the menopause, we kind of catch up with our companions. And that this vascular component can also add and contribute to that increased risk. But it's also true that in the most advanced age, so we know that dementia is pretty rare before the age of 65. And then it increases exponentially. We can roughly say that the occurrence, it doubles every 5 years. What happens after people are 80 and 85, it's a little bit less clear, if anything, because we have less refined tools. That is an age where vision loss, hearing impairment are very common. So it's hard to disentangle when you do a cognitive test how much the person is missing out because he's not understanding or because it has a loss on the brain capacity.
So I want to dig into this, actually, if you don't, sorry to interrupt you, but I know that it becomes very difficult because there can be comorbidities, but you also said that it's only noticed often after the age of 65. But of course, we are going to talk about how to prevent it, if possible, by healthy lifestyle way before 65. However, there are some research papers coming out now to show emerging factors such as hearing impairment, vision loss, even oral health. So there's so many other things. I mean, as a researcher yourself, I don't even know how you begin to untangle the various things because, of course, it affects every part of a person's body and life.
True. As a geriatrician, I've been taught very early on that the brain is one of the weakest links. So it needs to be protected. It's a main capital that we have to nurture and grow across the lifestyle. And it's true what you said, Lisa. The whole life of a person, we might be exposed to different risk factors. And how to decide what it is the most relevant for the specific individual. I think every person is very unique. We might have exposure during our life to different risk and also protective factors. And they might be important in different stages of life. So for instance, mental stimulation starts very early with going to school, but it can continue across the whole life because to have a job or leisure activity that are mentally challenging, it's very important. Physical activity, it's important across the whole life course, and so it is social stimulation. Then when we look at cardiovascular factor, for instance, we know that having high blood pressure, high blood cholesterol, or high blood sugar, or high body mass index on overweight, it's especially negative on our brain if that happens in our adult age. So we need to keep in mind all of these factors to kind of have an assessment of what is our capacity to build on our brain resilience. And because the literature covers us with new information every day, doing something, eating berries can be protective, and the next day you can see a glass of wine per week could be protective. We need to look at the synthesis. And the synthesis are available for everybody to see. There is the Lancet Commission on Dementia Prevention and Care, which has been done multiple times since 2017. We're now at the third edition that was published last year, and they show that up to 14 modifiable factors to which individuals can be exposed during lifestyle can account for almost 50% of dementia cases.
So I'm going to pause you right there, Francesca, because most people are not going to find or even may know about the Lancet or the Lancet's edition on dementia prevention. So you said there's five things. We just want you as the expert to tell us what do we do?
All right. So I can maybe say that as an expert, I'm based my knowledge on large group of scientists that built synthesis of this evidence. So Lancet or the...
Oh, we've slightly lost you there, Francesca. You've come back again. Sorry. Sorry, Francesca. We lost you for like 10 seconds. So just repeat that. The body of science tells us ...
The body of science that has been synthesized to understand what is the good level of evidence exists. And it shows us that there is a huge variety of factors that we can modify to increase our odds to have an healthy brain as we age. These factors are important at different stages of life. For some, for instance, cardiovascular health, keeping to check high blood pressure, high blood cholesterol, and overweight. It's incredibly important in our adult age. Being mentally, socially, and physically active, it's important across the whole lifestyle. And so it is, for instance, having good sleep hygiene or to have a healthy diet. So there is a huge amount of information that we can do. And the strong evidence also comes from clinical trial. The clinical trial is the type of study that gives the strongest evidence about the efficacy of an intervention. The finger model that Professor Kivipelto and the team where we are working.
Well, this is what I want to bring in. In fact, it was my next point, the finger study, because actually it was when I met Hassan at a brain conference, he was merrily chatting away and mentioned the finger study. And bear in mind, this is a brain conference. And I did not know what the finger study was. And so I just asked for hands up in the audience. Most of the people in the audience, well over half, did not know. And these are people working in the brain industry. So please make it very basic and tell us what is the finger study. And we are going to mention Professor Mia Kivipelto also, who couldn't join us, but she is, she and you are leading this research, really.
Yes. So in finger, it's a randomized clinical trial. And we, in that study, we took people from the community looking for those who had increased risk of dementia because of modifiable risk factors that were not well controlled. So for instance, lack of physical activity, overweight and obesity, high blood pressure, high blood cholesterol. And these people were not having any substantial cognitive problems. The people were randomly assigned to one of two groups. One group was receiving standard healthcare. The other group was doing the five ends of the finger intervention: physical activity, healthy diet, cognitive training, good control of cardiovascular health, and social stimulation. We show that after 2 years of this type of intervention, first of all, the intervention was well accepted. There was a very high adherence. Most of these people that were aged from 66 to 77, they could actually do the intervention. There were no side effects, and they actually improved in cognition. There was an improvement on global cognition, but also on specific cognitive function, like ability to remember, ability to think fast, ability to reasoning. These are all essential for functioning independently, and are more vulnerable because of aging and brain age diseases. So when we published the finger study in 2015, this was the first model showing that something can be done to benefit cognition in older adults at risk of dementia. And this was for us the very first model that enabled to show how the multi-domain approach can help in risk reduction of dementia.
Multi-domain
means that...
And also the fact that you had been there to help and hold their hands, because everything you've just said, it sounds so obvious. We know this. We know all of these things. But many of us do not do it. So I'm going to turn to Joelle, because you know this work. You work in this. You work with a fabulous professor, Reiko Kruger, who has been on my show before. And you have set up in Luxembourg something called a PDP program, which is raising awareness on these modifiable risk factors, which Francesca has just spoken about. But you also work, as Francesca has just said with the study, hand in hand with people and those who are at risk to help them. You even have incentivization vouchers. So I would like to know from you, how do people do this for themselves when they're not being helped by a whole research department like yours?
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you for being here also. Indeed, as you said, I'm here to represent the program Dementia Prevention, which is actually an initiative which was launched in 2018 based on the model that Francesca just nicely presented. And it's actually indeed taking people by the hand, but also to find out how to implement the latest scientific findings and to help people to do this, which then benefits the whole population.
And I just want to pause there, because that brings us right back to Hassan's story, because when you say it benefits a whole population, we are an aging population. I know Angie's going to tell us more about that in a few moments, but also it has a huge weight on the caregivers.
Yes, indeed. So, and that's indeed an important information, because caregivers also sometimes are lost. They don't know where to go. Maybe they are aware of the risk factors, maybe they are not. But if they are, even then, they don't know how to handle this situation. And this is why the program Dementia Prevention is actually there, because it's really structured and it helps people to find their way, but also to raise awareness on what exists, not only for participants, but also for caregivers and healthcare professionals. So it's really, as I said in the beginning, my role is actually to bring research closer to participants. This is the exact example. So here there's research findings, but PDP is actually implementing this. So PDP stands in short for Program Dementia Prevention.
And I want to bring Angie in here, because you also mentioned, you've mentioned, Francesca's mentioned, it's not just the families or the people who are suffering from dementia, but when I asked the question at the beginning, just is dementia inevitable, there's a very high percentage of healthcare professionals who think dementia is actually just something to be accepted with old age. I think you probably have the numbers in front of you. I can remember a number of, I don't know if it's the right number, but I have 67% in my head. I don't know if that's right or wrong.
Yep, that's definitely one of the numbers. So this is actually referring to a piece of work that colleagues of ours at Alzheimer's Disease International did. So they did a big survey last year, and they were wanting to understand stigma across the world, actually. So they asked in Europe, in the US, in low and middle income countries, and they wanted to find out, and they were, I think, expecting to see and hoping to see a reduction in stigma in different parts of society. So they're asking people, when we say the word dementia, what do you think? What does it mean to you? What do you know about the condition? And those types of questions. And what they found, unfortunately, was that a lot of people still believe that dementia is an inevitable part of aging. And I think that is at the root of the stigma that Hassan mentioned, that him and his family have been suffering from, or suffered from, when his dad was living with dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Because I think people misunderstand that dementia is not an inevitability as you age. It is a disease. It's something that develops over time. And it's also a condition, actually. There are a lot of negative images of dementia that are really prevalent. For example, if you ask someone what do they think of when they hear the word Alzheimer's or dementia, a lot of the images that they will come up with are really not very positive images. And as an organization, as Alzheimer Europe, and with our members, who are all national Alzheimer associations, we really want to promote a balanced view of dementia, really show that it's not, we really want to challenge some of the negative stereotypes that exist, because it has an incredibly negative impact on people's lives. And people can be empowered to live well with dementia at all stages of the disease.
It's reminding me a little bit, it's not a parallel, but I know that a lot of men age and live with prostate cancer through the latter years of their lives, but they can live extremely well and often will not die of that. So perhaps you're saying, in another way that Francesca has said, you can delay the effects by changing one's habits. So this brings me back to you, Joelle. again, those five things that Francesca has mentioned, those things that, I mean, I look at her son and you can see he's doing them 1,000 times over than any human being. Not many of us are going to do five Ironman races in a year. Why don't we do this?
I think this is actually also because, first, as I said, the awareness might not be there. But even if it's there, as Francesca mentioned, there are 14 risk factors modifiable, but maybe these are all not true for, or some only with you, because you have an life and you live and you have different exposures. So it's difficult for you to know on what to act. And that's the advantage also of the program here. It's actually you get taken by the hand, you have a risk factor profile, and then it's actually made based on this. There's incentivation to do something against this, but it's also saying that people want to do this, and so it's to choose an activity which suits you. It's personalized, and this helps. And I just wanted to come back to the healthcare professional, because it's more than awareness. It's actually they are needed, because even there are modifiable risk factors. Some people know about it, but it's still healthcare professional who need to do something against, like hypertension or something like this. It's the doctor who actually gives you the medication or regulates this, and it's fine if you know it, but you need to go to a doctor. And so I think this networking, which then with this program is established, helps a lot, and you don't feel alone and you know where to go.
Because dementia can be something that makes your life even more isolating. And of course, we have to consider those who don't have family around to help them or support them. And then not only is it a terrible situation for that person on their own trying to get through it, but it's a societal weight also. And again, Anja, I remember you telling us some stories, and the word stigma is a very important one for you to break down through this conversation amongst many, many other things. But you were talking about the Democratic Republic of Congo, where even other cultures have a completely different mindset when it comes to this.
Yeah, I think it was Francesca who mentioned this as well. It's people have different words to refer to dementia. So I think the example she raised was within the work they've been doing in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Dementia is seen as a malediction, a curse that affects a family. And when you have a perception like that, it becomes very, very hard even to talk about dementia, because there is a sort of inherent barrier. It's a personal barrier. People don't want to talk about the condition. They maybe don't want to acknowledge the condition even. And half of the challenge with dementia is getting over people's perceptions of the disease. Because if you think there's nothing I can do about it, this is something inevitable, why would you even try?
Well, this flips the conversation perfectly into the question of our healthcare at the moment, and the fact that so much of our healthcare is on dealing with the problem when it happens, but not much money is put into prevention. So Francesca, Hassan, I know that the work you're doing in different spheres, I mean, you're coming from different points of view, but let's just open up that thought. I have 4% in front of me here. I don't know if that's accurate, and I'm sure that the figure fluctuates, but Francesca and Hassan, to you both, really, how can we shift that? I think it needs to shift personally, because we're moving into a society where, again, everything you've said is about how we are living during our lives before we hit the big diseases.
Maybe I can start to share some reflection and then I'll pass it over to Hassan. What I think, what is important is that science and translation of science and implementation needs to go hand in hand. For instance, when the finger results came out, there is an important message, but still is not enough to have one study that gives that answer. Because we know very well that, the multi-domain approach where we do multiple things at the same time, it's important, but is it, for instance, feasible and effective also in other contexts? Finger study was done in one country that has very specific geographical and cultural condition. That was Finland. So would that work in other setting? To answer that question, the finger model has been now adapted and is being tested for feasibility and efficacy in at least 70 other countries. Professor Miyakimi Pelto has been launching what is called the Worldwide Finger Global Network for multi-domain trial for dementia risk reduction, where we are interacting with, we do create community all over the world with 70 countries in every continent, including Africa, to try to see what is a relevant adaptation and evolution of the finger mod. And we have this, doing this effort, having in mind that there is no one-size-fits-all solution. We need tailored intervention to be effective. This is called precision medicine, and we know it exists in some field. For instance, in oncology, breast cancer start as one disease. Now we know it's a large subtypes of disease that allow people to be treated with a specific cure. It's the same for dementia risk reduction, where eventually we will be using lifestyle and medication. So at each stage of the person experiencing just brain pathology or also memory problem, we can offer something that is tailored and is sustainable. And I think at the moment, what we are doing put a lot of responsibility in the individual. The doctor needs to give the right medication, the right advice, but it's a lot of the person sticking up to the therapy, having the capacity and the resources to eat healthy, which can be quite expensive in some countries. So also the population level needs to come in. What can the society do to make physical activity more easy to do? The healthy choice should be the easiest choice. And I don't think it's still the case everywhere. But that is coming. So for instance, in Sweden, the government took up the FINGER program and put it in the new dementia strategy that was published a couple of months ago. So science is reaching the policymaker, those that can actually help implementing. And I think the work that Hassan is doing is really helping raising the voice and the making the policymaker and other stakeholders to pay attention to this and move it forward.
Yeah, thank you, Francesca. You are dealing, I'm very glad the Swedish government are noticing what they have on their doorstep there and the wonderful work that you're doing. And Hassan, also, you're doing it in a different way. You are really grassroots level almost. You are, you know, running right across Europe and you're making the documentary. So you're really touching communities. You're going into schools. You're talking to the children. And so you're dealing with it from the ground up, and perhaps Francesca's dealing with it from the top down, perhaps.
Yeah, we are lucky to meet up with the young team across schools in France, in Switzerland, in Spain, soon hopefully in Sweden as well. And what we see that the young team is eager to better understand the cause of this brain disease and prevention for brain health. And the kids are very enthusiastic when they see the engagement, the social engagement, that we can do something. Everybody can do something to make our life better. And as a solidarity initiative, we can build up a kind of good practices. When Francesca mentioned social stimulation, cognitive stimulation, physical activity, I mean, those are in principle, you can activate this plan the very next day, because going for a walk or you just need for a walk for 20 minutes a day, I mean, it's accessible, and disconnect a bit from your mobile phone and get some real friends, meeting up with some real friends to dance the salsa or Zumba. It's a cognitive it's a cognitive stimulation, it's social experience, and you are also having fun, physical activity. So we are discussing with some government to deploy and to promote this prevention program across schools. And when we talk about government, about budget, because we are an NGO, we are a non-profit organization, and of course we receive invitation from high schools and schools everywhere, but we need to some extent to be supported. And when I look at the prevention, the healthcare budget for prevention in France and Switzerland is around 4 or 5%. So I think a lot needs to be done in prevention. We can deploy a lot, a strong message. We can really deploy a very nice program, but we need also the budget aspect has a key played role here as well.
I'm glad you mentioned dance, because I do remember last time Reiko Kruger was on the show and he was talking about prevention. He said dance is a wonderful thing because it's mixing movement with social engagement.
Yeah, I agree. So, and I just wanted to mention that actually here in Luxembourg, we might then be privileged because indeed the program Dementia Prevention is financed by the Ministry of Health. So this is something which they see that the prevention is actually... And to bring it to the broader public, we actually recently launched an application so that it's actually not only for a target group, which is homogenized in the PDP program, but it's to the broad public. It's also to follow the same principle. So you have a risk profile, you answer a questionnaire, and you get to know which risk profile you have. And then actually each day you have to crack a nut to see if actually you do, now you have a risk factor, which might be, you should eat healthier, then maybe your crack the nut is actually have a good recipe that you could cook at home. So there's
sorry, when you say crack a nut, do you mean really crack a nut?
So the image is like this. So oh. It's really like each day you need to crack a nut and then you get...
Just wondering if grip strength is a sign of dementia.
No, but this is actually something, it's like something you do each day and you get reminded. So it's really to raise awareness, but also, as I said before, to really have a profile where you can work on. And this app is available in Luxembourg.
And we will link to it. It's called the Brain Coach app.
Exactly.
I wanted to turn it back then to, well, I'm sure all of you can answer it, but perhaps Stan, because we're saying a lot of things here, and we have the five study, you know, live a good life, a healthy life, all those things that we sort of know in our heads, we don't always manage it on a daily basis. But when do you start noticing, and again, of course, I know the profile is different for different people, but what should families be looking out for in parents, perhaps, or loved ones or friends of any age, what even in ourselves, what should we be looking out for as the first signs of dementia or Alzheimer's, to bundle it into one?
The key message we spread during this campaign is the early diagnosis. And thank you for the question, Lisa. Early diagnosis is key. As early you diagnose dementia or brain disease, then you can take actions within your family and you can take the right actions to take care of your beloved ones. And the first one coming very often, memory loss. It's a memory loss. Yes, sorry. It's memory loss, and also there is kind of starting to be messy with the little things. My dad, in this sense, he was not really much losing memory, but he was disorganized. So was clearly something not going right. He was always very structured, very organized, and one day to very next days, then he started to be deorganized, and he started to also to forget things, and also about the senses like smelling and hearing loss is also symptoms of something is going wrong. And then we took too long due to the stigma and trauma to visit a doctor. And my dad knew that he was losing a kind of his integrity, and he's a very organized, very structured way. He knew that something was going on, but he was scared about the stigma and trauma. He knew that maybe it's Alzheimer, and everybody knows that Alzheimer is one of the worst disease that you can get at this age. And we tried to push my dad to go to see a doctor to get this early diagnosis or this diagnosis, and then so we can organize ourselves to better care about him and about my mom as well. You know, so symptoms, as soon as you have a clear sign of something is changing in your senses, in your memory loss, in your organization, in your daily activities are impacted. If you are trying to not to change your habits, then you need to visit a doctor.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to hand that over to Ange now, because I know that the numbers are big here. I've got the numbers in front of me here. And just listening to you relive that story, Hassan, there's so many other parts of this. It's the person who's got the dementia themselves, their own sense of worth and their own identity is changing. And of course, what that means for the years to come, upending the family life and the structure of a family home in order to care. So there's so many things there. And the aging demographics in Europe, we haven't leaned on them so far, but
they're there
and they're not nothing. I mean, this is going to be a problem if we don't tackle it.
I mean, you know, we need to adapt as a society. It's inevitable that we are an aging society.
Especially Europe.
especially Europe, yes, Europe, but also, you know, some other countries too, Japan, less so the lower middle income countries, but certainly in the Western countries in Europe, we certainly have an aging demographic. And currently we have around 21% of people living in Europe who are over 65 years of age. And while dementia, Alzheimer's disease is not an inevitable part of aging, the greatest single unmodifiable risk factor for Alzheimer's disease and dementia is age. So you mentioned, Lisa, earlier on that as you get older,
we can't change that one.
But, you know, there is still so much we can do. We can think about resilience. We can think about healthy aging. And healthy aging, it's something that we can all do as individuals, but actually we would challenge governments to step up and take a more active role in promoting healthy aging, not just looking at people as a resource for work, for GDP, for economic prowess, but also look at people as a resource for society, brain capital, human capital. And, you know, I think by our message really would be by taking a personalized approach to healthy aging, we can all be individually empowered, and we have our individual roles. We have our role at Alzheimer Europe in trying to reduce stigma, in getting people to talk a little bit more about Alzheimer's disease and dementia, not in a way that they should be scared of it. Because even if you develop Alzheimer's disease and dementia, there are things you can do. You can live a fulfilled life. Organizations such as the Association Luxembourg Alzheimer, France Alzheimer, some of the patient associations have a fantastic program of support and psychosocial support classes that people can do. We talked about dancing. I know just across the border in Metz, there's a couple who are running tango classes for people who are living with dementia, and they have a fantastic time. And the people who are engaging in those classes live and are living a fulfilled life. But we think that governments do need to step up and start funding, acknowledging the aging demographic, funding prevention efforts, talking about dementia in the same space as they talk about cardiovascular risk reduction. Because what's healthy for your heart is healthy for your brain. And if we can harness some of that impetus to change our habits and build brain capital, there's so much we can do.
Well, that's such a lovely, I have the vision of that dancing class, that tango class in Metz, actually. And it reminds me again, I mean, it brings me back to what you were saying, you know, governments in so many of the parts of the world, not all governments, but most, you know, they're looking at money and economic development for the GDP. But we can measure that in other ways, too. And one of them is societal happiness, which one government in the world at least does. So if you were just to give us one thing that we should do, it can be in relation to any part of your work. And what should we do and make it a part of our life?
Oh, it's so hard, isn't it? Because, you know, Joël said something that I think is very important. You know, personalized prevention has the greatest power to make a change because we're all different. I can't tell my husband to go and join a tango class. I mean, he would look at me.
Well, you could.
But he wouldn't do it and he wouldn't enjoy it and there would be no point. So my message is, look at to people would, I guess, be to look at your own lives. What brings value to you? What parts, you know, thinking about the finger model where we're talking about physical activity, cardiovascular health, you know, dropping some of those unhealthier things we do, getting mobile, engaging with our friends. Think about different things you can do within those categories and then just go out and do them. You know, find the time, you know, that there's lots of stuff around mindfulness and finding yourself in the moment, but take a little bit of time every day just to think about what you did, what you enjoyed, and one single healthy change you can make in the next day for brain healthy activities.
So that you can live a long life.
So that you can live a long life. Yeah, exactly. With your family, you know, and with your families, with your friends. And there are things you can do if you do develop dementia, if you do develop Alzheimer's disease. So whatever you do, don't be afraid, you know, talk, have the conversations, have the hard conversations too. What's going to happen when you get older? What's going to happen with your parents? Where would they like to live? What are their preferences? These are all really important things. And that's why early diagnosis is important.
You're bringing us on to
the questions.
A power of attorney conversation I need to move on to at some point, but we won't do it this week. And thank you so much for everything that you've brought. And I know you're based here in Luxembourg, but of course it's an umbrella-wide association for Europe. And everything that you write about makes sense for anybody in the world. Thank you, Joelle. And you're right, we are privileged here in Luxembourg to have such incredible resources as well. And I'm quite sure other people in other countries can also download the app.
Yes, you can on the browser. Indeed, you need to be located in Luxembourg to have it on the iPhone or on the smartphone, but you can on the browser.
So it's open to everybody. And again, Francesca, I know at the moment the Finger Study is operating in about 70 countries, and I know your colleague is flying to America right now, no doubt, to talk about something related to this. So thank you for the great research that you continue to do there in the Karolinska Institute. And Hassan, I'm sure we'll see you in Luxembourg sometime soon, even if it's on a bike or you're swimming through the Moselle or you're jogging your way through Mullertal. I'm sure one of those three will bring you to Luxembourg. Thank you all so much for your time. And if you are suffering with dementia, you have a family member, again, we would love to hear from you, because, you know, part of this conversation is about destigmatizing, and we do that by opening up the conversation. If you have any tips or tricks that have helped you as a family, we would really love to hear from you. So this is just one opening doorway into destigmatizing that conversation. And we were going to all go away and take a little bit of moment of every day, as Ange suggested, so that we can think about what we can do to improve our longevity and a healthy brain as we hopefully age. Thank you all so much.